We are this evening going to begin a discussion of scientific foreknowledge as a proof of Bible inspiration. And so if you will, turn in your booklet to page 10. And by the way, while I'm thinking about it, I have a couple of typos that one can make note of on page 11 of the text, if you have that. With regard to the third bullet point on the page, touching dead bodies, the reference is Numbers chapter 19 instead of Leviticus. You will make that note. And also the date there is incorrect. I think that I saw 1873 in the bullet above and repeated that, but it's 1847 is the correct date. In 1847, an Austrian obstetrician. So you might want to make note of those two corrections, and I'll make sure that I'll make the correction on the material up online as well that we've uploaded to the site. But we have been discussing up to this point in time, as we've talked about the concept of apologetics, the inspiration of the Bible, and we have centered our discussion up to this point in what we've referred to as historical accuracy, looking at some of the archaeological discoveries which serve to corroborate the Bible accounts concerning people, places, and events. And we made note of the fact as we began that discussion that this is by no means going to be an exhaustive discussion of these things. It's just simply a few examples that we would give you. But we emphasize with regard to the historical, archaeological, factual accuracy of the Bible, that as archaeology uncovers more and more items in the digs, the finds, those things that they uncover that constitute what we might refer to as physical evidence concerning past events and people and places and such, that it seems that again and again and again, even disputed claims in the Bible or characters or places, events that historians dispute and say did not happen, or there's no evidence that it happened, that those things are revealed to have been accurate. It's not to say that in every single case, everything that is uncovered corroborates the Bible, or that all the things that the Bible says are corroborated, because that's obviously something that's impossible, and some things are in dispute, and there are different interpretations that are placed upon it. But there are no archaeological finds that individuals can point to and say, see, this proves that the Bible is wrong. And those things do not exist. And as we examine those things, as more is uncovered, then that helps to validate the claim that we have that the Bible is the product of inspiration. And the same thing is true with regard to this concept of scientific foreknowledge. But there are some caveats that I want to express before we begin. First of all, not every claim example of scientific foreknowledge is legitimate. I have seen bulletin articles and listened to sermons preached to where claims have been made concerning the Bible showing something scientifically that is in reality either not legitimate or difficult, if not impossible, to prove or to write the claims legitimate. So what I've tried to do is to be very careful and circumspect with regard to the examples that I gave. Want to make note as well that we cannot expect the Bible to be replete with examples of scientific knowledge that predates in its accuracy what the common man would have known or understood, because the Bible is not a scientific textbook. It doesn't deal with scientific matters at all. Nor should we expect, if the Bible does reveal certain things that seem to be ahead of its time with regard to scientific knowledge, that it would be using either technical language that is scientific in nature, nor would we expect that the purpose of revealing these data that we reveal, that the purpose is to prove any scientific thing. That's not what the Bible is about. I'll just give you as an example, when we begin to talk about the things concerning leprosy and the handling of dead bodies. There is a term that is used in reference to both of those concerning the condition of the Jew who does that, who either has leprosy or who has handled leprosy or handled an unclean body or a dead body or some of the other things, is they're considered unclean. Well, it's a ritual uncleanness that's under consideration in that text. I think there is some legitimacy to saying that these laws had a purpose in hygiene, in keeping individuals from sickness. That will become very clear as we look at the one of leprosy. But the uncleanness in part was to teach the people of Israel that God was holy, and if you approach God, you must be cleansed, you must be sanctified. You cannot approach God without proper respect. And a part of that proper respect is presenting yourself holy before Him before you come to worship Him. So it had a religious purpose to it, certainly. But it did have a secondary aspect as well with regard to dietary restrictions, with regard to hygiene and some of these other laws to protect the children of Israel. And this will become obvious as we get into some discussions with regard to these things. But we shouldn't expect these things to be explicit and to be centered on the concept of science. But having said all of that, on occasion, the Bible does contain information that reveals a knowledge of certain aspects, perhaps geological or geographical aspects of the world that would not be readily available to the ancient man. Things concerning hygiene, things concerning nutrition, that seem to indicate a knowledge of scientific principles that were not available through natural knowledge or natural discovery. And in fact, when we look at some of the things that is found, especially in the Old Testament with regard to the dietary restrictions of the Jews, that kind of thing, you find that it's not until maybe the 1800s or even the 1900s when individuals became aware of why these things were so. And so these can be used to indicate that there was a knowledge that is found in Scripture, which argues to inspiration. Man couldn't know it naturally, but God certainly did, as He is the creator of the universe and the maker of man. So that's kind of the principle that surrounds this idea of scientific foreknowledge. These principles that we're going to look at, these examples, to some are extremely appealing as evidence and proof. They are amazing as you consider them, contemplate them. The first one that we're going to talk about with regard to circumcision is an example of that. It is really kind of an amazing fact with regard to 8-day circumcision. But some others may not be touched by this particularly. So I must confess to the fact that I'm more enthralled with the factual accuracy, the archaeological finds, and those kinds of things than I am this. Maybe one of the reasons is because I'm not real comfortable with being able to discern between those things that are legitimate and those things that are not with regard to scientific foreknowledge. So I'm a bit careful and want to be circumspect with regard to these things. The four that I chose, or five, I think there are five total, that I chose to put in the booklet were all advocated on that website, the Apologetics Press, or Answers of Genesis. I think it's Apologetics Press, it's the one we've been looking at more often than not, and seem to be legitimate. So you can give them the consideration that you want with regard to that. Let's start off by talking about the circumcision. Now, we've already read in our text in Genesis chapter 17 and verses 3 through 8 the statement of that covenant that God made with Abraham. You'll notice in the first couple of verses of Genesis 17, it was when Abram was 99 years old that the Lord appeared to him and said, "I am Almighty God, walk before me and be blameless, and I will make my covenant between me and you and will multiply you exceedingly." And Abram fell on his face and God talked with him. And we related what what Josh read with regard to the covenant itself. Now, dropping down to verse 9 of the text, you'll note that God said to Abraham, "As for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you throughout your generations. And this is the covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after you. Every male child among you shall be circumcised, and you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskins, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you. He who is 8 days old among you shall be circumcised, every male child in your generations. He who is born in your house or bought with money from any foreigner who is not your descendant, who is born in your house and who is brought with your money, must be circumcised, and my covenant shall be in your flesh for an everlasting covenant." Now you'll notice there, especially in verse 11 of the text, that the circumcision, the process of circumcision of male children, was a sign of the covenant between me and you. And this is the token or the sign of that covenant. Circumcision had a religious significance to the Jew. Now for Gentile, it was not a common practice. In our society, it is mixed, but it is for the most part a cultural consideration, no longer of any significance religiously. In the New Covenant, you'll remember that the Apostle Paul indicated very clearly that it's not the physical circumcision under the New Covenant that makes any difference or distinction, but rather the circumcision of the heart. So the significance is not this ritual, this physical surgery that was performed on male children, but rather it is something that is different, and the sign and the token is a spiritual one rather than a physical one. But until the establishment of the New Covenant, it was something of great importance to the Jew. And it was something that was ritually performed. And of course, even today, you've heard of a brisk. That is, you have, I think they call it Hebrew individual who does some oil. They have basically a religious service on the eighth day where the Jewish male child is circumcised. So that's even the practice today in and among the Jews. What the circumcision is, of course, is the removal of male foreskin. And the reason why this is a significance for us and our consideration this evening is because the surgery on a small child, a newborn babe, that is surgery, that has a risk with regard to bleeding, with regard to hemorrhaging. So just want you to note on the second slide that I've got here a quote from Holt's Pediatrics, which is a classic work that was written in 1953, and at least for a while. I'm sure that it has been superseded, but for a long while was recognized as an authority with regard to pediatric care. You'll notice that Holt states that a newborn infant has a peculiar susceptibility to bleeding between the second and fifth days of life. And hemorrhages at this time, though often inconsequential, are sometimes extensive, and they may produce serious damage to internal organs, especially to the brain, and cause death from shock and exsanguination. So the idea is that a child between the ages of 2 and 5 days are vulnerable to hemorrhaging because the clotting factors in the blood are undeveloped. And that's basically the reason for this. Now, this might would be considered a danger, especially in ancient times, when the same kinds of medicines and procedures that we have in modern medicine to take care of those things were not available. Now, you know, with regard to both of my sons, I forget now, with regard to the time of Josh with Jeremiah, I think it was the very next day after he was born, that we had our son circumcised. So the date was not quite as a significant thing with regard to that because doctors could take care of it. You know, there were those considerations that they did not have in ancient times. But there was a specific command given by God. And this was not something that was practiced by Abraham and his family or his descendants before. This was a new thing, this covenant or token of circumcision. It was necessary that all be circumcised, both adults and children. And it was from that point on for the Jew the practice that on the eighth day the male child would be circumcised. So up until that point in time, There wasn't trial and error. There wasn't experimentation as to which the best thing is. It was simply a command as a part of this token, this covenant, the sign of the covenant between them, that it would be on the eighth day. This is a command that is given from God. Well, why is that the case? Well, it's an interesting phenomenon with regard to the newborn child. And what happens is a combination of vitamin K and and prothrombin. And I'm not sure what prothrombin is, but it's something in the blood that is produced by the liver. But those two things combined are those things that bring about the clotting of the blood. And so if you go and you look at what medical science has discovered with regard to newborn babies, vitamin K levels are not adequate until days 5 to 7. Now, vitamin K is produced by bacteria that is in the intestinal tract. It takes some time for the vitamin K to begin to be produced. And so there is a vulnerability, since the vitamin K is what triggers in the liver the production of the prothrombin, that there is a vulnerability early on in the child's life. And so vitamin K kicks in on average, and these things are, of course, averages from 5 to 7 days. And it is as a result of that that the prothrombin begins to be produced. And the interesting thing about all this is that on day 8, with regard to a normal male child, not with regard to every male child, and it certainly could be as you get older, there might be some disease or something that hits you or some condition to increase it. But in a normal person's life, the prothrombin levels in the blood are above the normal. And we'll put the norm as at 100%. You know, you're at 100% exactly what it should be. It's only on day 8 that it actually exceeds that. Only on the 8th day of a person's life, a male child's life, no other time, unless there is some kind of a problem that might arise. But for a healthy person, for a regular person, day 8 is the highest day. 110%, if you take the norm, it goes up to 110%. And by the way, with regard to that, I didn't put it up on the board, but there was a chart that I was looking at as I was researching this, and the chart kind of gave a little bit of a curve with regard to the days and the percentage, had the levels and then the percentage. Well, with regard to the percentage, from day 1, it begins to the level begins to drop at the end of the first day. And from about 80%, the level's about 80% at the beginning. And then at about day 3, it drops down 40%. And then by day 5, it's back up to about 80%. And then it gradually climbs until it's about 110% of the normal level on day 8. So you can kind of see where, especially like on days 2 through 4, or as indicated in Holt's Pediatrics, with regard to the second and fifth dates, between the second and fifth dates, that the baby is very much vulnerable, hemorrhaging. And so it would not be a good time, especially if you had limited abilities to stop bleeding, it would not be a good time to practice circumcision. But on the eighth day, the circumstances are ideal, which is kind of an interesting thing. Let me give you a couple of quotes in this regard. The first is a book that is entitled None of These Diseases, that was written by S.I. McMillan, a medical doctor. And I actually have two quotes from him, one a little bit later if we get to it. But this is his statement in regard to this particular thing. Medical doctor saying this: we should commend the many hundreds of workers who labored at great expense over a number of years to discover that the safest day to perform circumcision is the eighth. In other words, they didn't just take the Bible's word for it. That science has worked on this, and medical science, medical workers, to determine what is the optimum day to perform the circumcision. But he says, yet as we congratulate medical science for the recent finding, we can almost hear the leaves of the Bible rustling. They would like to remind us that 4,000 years ago, when God initiated circumcision with Abraham, that Abraham did not pick the eighth day after many centuries of trial and error experiments. Neither he nor any of his company from the ancient city of Ur and the Chaldees had ever been circumcised. There was a day picked by the creator of vitamin K. I kind of like that phrase. Picked by the creator of vitamin K. So that is an example that we have. The example of circumcision on the eighth day. Of the scientific foreknowledge that we refer to. And again, we will state that with regard to these things, as we had mentioned before, none of these serve as an absolute proof concerning Bible inspiration. You can take as an example other maybe ancient works that have something in them that would seem to indicate something similar. What we're talking about with regard to the claim of Bible inspiration, two parts. Number one, the Bible claims it for itself. So the Bible says it's inspired. So the claim is made, and the only way to prove that, well, let's say the positive proof of that is something that is a matter of degree, in the sense that no matter the evidence that I supply in this regard, some aren't going to accept it. Some are not going to say that it's legitimate or sufficient. But if you have a lack of scientific contradiction, you have, for example, in other ancient writings, the statement that the world sits on the back of a giant turtle that's swimming in a cosmic sea. That's the way. That's why the world is suspended, because it's on the top back of a giant turtle. Well, that's obviously a legend that has no basis in scientific fact, and we know that to be the case. And so we can indicate from that is the product of man rather than the product of inspiration, that it's a story rather than a legitimate truth. And so when we look at the Bible and we see that these things line up with what we know to be scientific truths. And by the way, there are times in the past to where individuals have denied certain aspects of what the Bible teaches, and then they have come around to the Bible way of thinking after they've discovered other things. But with regard to those things we can corroborate, they seem to ring true again and again and again. So that gives evidence, supplies evidence that these things are in actuality inspired of God. When we get to the point, which we're getting to a little bit later in our discussion, when we get into Bible prophecy, then I'm going to be adamant saying this proves the Bible is inspired. Now, there are certain things about biblical prophecy that I think is undeniable with regard to the prophecies concerning the Messiah, with regard to the prophecies concerning events which transpired in history that were predicted by the prophets. Sometimes the very names, other times very explicit historical events and dates and kingdoms and all sorts of things, where I think that there is the evidence, where the evidence of inspiration is to be found most legitimately. But these things serve to corroborate that, the accuracy that we have. So that's the first example that we have about circumcision. Anybody have any comments before we go on? All right, then let us go to the next one. And we're going to be talking about some of the dietary restrictions that limits placed by God upon the people of Israel. And there were a number of animals that were considered to be unclean animals and divisions that God made with regard to that. And again, I will emphasize that these restrictions had a legitimate religious purpose, that these restrictions were placed upon the Jews so that they would acknowledge the righteousness of God and acknowledge the requirements of God that they be pure before Him in order to worship Him. And you'll see this time and time again with regard to behavior. You'll remember when Nadab and Abihu offered up the strange fire, the profane fire. The word strange is used in some translations, profane or unclean fire. So what's under consideration in that case, that when Aaron came to Moses, and Moses explained what the Lord had said, that Aaron kept his peace. Remember, he didn't say anything. He didn't complain about what was said because God had said, by those who come before me, I must be regarded as holy. And where we would look and we would say, what difference does the fire make? What difference does it make where it comes from? What is the source of that fire? God had given explicit instructions, and by keeping those instructions, individuals were respecting the holiness of God. So anytime we look at things like this, again, it is a secondary application that we make. If God said it was unclean, and he said it was unclean arbitrarily, it was still unclean because God said so. And the Jews were enjoined to obey the command and refrain from eating those things simply because of his plan. However, in the case with, for example, pork, which was considered an unclean thing, there is, as we all know, this is something we're familiar with, a benefit to refraining from eating pork. I'm not saying that you shouldn't eat pork today or that it's not safe to eat pork today, but it certainly could be construed as unsafe to eat pork in times past with regard to the preparation of that. So let's look at that text from Leviticus, the 11th chapter, verses 7 and 8. That the swine, though it divides the hoof, having cloven hooves, it does not chew the cud, and it is unclean to you. The flesh you shall not eat, and their carcasses you shall not touch. They are unclean to you. And one of the articles that I was reading is indicated that there is no evidence that any other ancient civilization had such restrictions. And of course, that's something that is corroborated in the Bible text, as it was a common practice of the Gentile to eat those things, whereas the Jew refrained from it. One of the reasons why the Gentile was considered unclean was because of his diet. To the Jew, he ate things that were profane and those things that he should not. It's an interesting thing when you look at Acts chapter 10 with regard to Peter's vision, where God told him to rise, Peter, and said, my lips have not touched any unclean thing. He was not willing to initially until God said, what I have cleansed you must not call unclean. Or common. So there is that very real restriction that was placed upon the Jew with regard to pork. Now, just give you a couple of things to note with regard to pork. Again, I like pork chops, and I like ham, and I like bacon, but I want my wife to cook it good and to be careful the way she prepares it, because pigs are scavengers, and they often ingest parasites. And there are three parasites that were specifically mentioned. One, which caused trichinosis in humans. And I think trichinosis is ringworm. Is that not correct? Anybody know that?
No. It's in the stomach.
It's the stomach?
It's muscles.
Okay. In the muscles? Okay. The it goes into the muscles. Okay.
Ringworms. Fungus is not really a worm at all.
Okay. That shows you what I know. For some reason, I saw ringworm somewhere, and I thought that was what we referred to. Okay, so the trichinosis is the parasite in the muscle tissues. Okay. Then also, pigs are known carriers as an inbreeding host of the tapeworm. And then finally, there is a third parasite called Echinococcus granulosis, or can I say it or can I say it? And it can cause tumors in liver, lungs, and other parts of the body. So how do you get that? You get that through the parasite living in the pig, and then the pig being raw or undercooked when it's eaten. And as a result of that, the parasite is not killed, and the parasite takes up a place in the human. And that's where this comes about. And it's not very common in our day and time for a number of reasons. Number one, with regard to the pork that you get in the grocery store, there are limitations as to what they can be fed in order for them to pass the inspection so that they can be sold in the grocery store. So, for example, just pulling the slop out like it was done back in the past, it's not done anymore. They're very careful to try to keep the pigs from getting parasites initially. And then, of course, they're very careful with regard to how they handle it, the preparation of the meat. And then there are, of course, guidelines that every cook, notice I didn't say every wife and mother, I said every cook in the audience knows about with regard to especially pork. fashion. Of course, you're supposed to cook all meat and reach a certain temperature, but I don't know how many times I've heard it said in the past, you have to be extremely careful with regard to pork especially. There is a quote that I want to give you from the, this is actually from the Center of Disease Control website, cdc.gov, and it is a... I thought someone was asking me a question for a second. Well, with regard to the cdc.gov, their frequently asked questions on the parasites page, it talks about that trichinellosis, and it says that it's less common today than it used to be. Why? Well, it used to be more common because it was caused by ingestion of undercooked pork. Infection is now relatively rare. During 2008 to 2010, 20 cases were reported per year on average. That's in the United States. The number of cases decreased beginning in the mid-20th century because of legislation prohibiting the feeding of raw meat garbage to hogs, the commercial and home freezing of pork, and the public awareness of the danger of eating raw or undercooked pork products. So nowadays, why do people get it? Well, because they eat undercooked wild game, not because of pork, because of the preparation of pork. Back in the days of the Jews in the Old Covenant, that wasn't the case. And there were these prohibitions that were placed upon it. And so there is a nutritional, a disease control behind the refusal of these eating pork that is found in that prohibition. So that could be an indication, again, of some knowledge that you know, we have, that we recognize and have recognized for some time, but that the ancients did not have with regard to why these kinds of diseases came about or why these parasites inhabited bodies. They didn't know it was from that reason, but there was an indication again from this particular prohibition. So that is another example. The nutritional limitations of the Jews is something that helped to keep them physically more healthy than they would be otherwise. All right? Okay, then third one. I don't necessarily have that. Now, if there's question that you have, I won't be able to answer it, but you can ask it. Maybe someone in the group can answer it if there's something you're I'm unclear on that you want clarity to. But we're going to go through these fairly quick, although there is one that we're going to make note of and we're going to wait until next week. I want to spend a little time with regard to the ocean trenches. We're going to pass over that when we come back to it next time. And I may have a couple of other geological/geographical things to note as well next week. So I kind of passed over that to the other. But let's talk now about the concept of quarantine. Now, this is found in Leviticus chapter 13. You may want to turn in your Old Testament there. Leviticus is a place that has many of these prohibitions concerning what is clean, what is unclean, and much of the actual physical laws that govern the Israelites as a nation. And there is an entire chapter, the 13th chapter, that is taken in a discussion of the various restrictions and laws concerning leprosy. Now, leprosy is not something that is particularly problematic in our time. It was the scourge of the ancient world. There was nothing worse than it. Now, the reason why is because of how horrific a disease it was. A person who got leprosy, as the disease advanced, it would lead to the loss of skin and fingers and toes and your body parts basically sloughed off as a result of leprosy. It was a horrific thing, and as a result of how bad it was, there were laws that were given concerning quarantining the leper. Now, if you look at the 13th chapter, you find that a priest is, who I guess was kind of the equivalent of the doctor in this regard. It was a medical exam that was given. And this priest, let's start with just verse 2. When a man has on the skin of his body a swelling, a scab, or a bright spot, it has become on the skin of his body like a leprous sore. something certainly that was common enough at that time where people would look at it and say, you know, that might be leprosy. Well, he shall be brought to Aaron the priest, or to one of his sons the priest, and the priest shall examine the sore on the skin of his body. And if the hair on the sore is turned white, the sore appears to be deeper than the skin of his body, it's a leprous sore. The priest shall examine him, pronounce him unclean. But if the bright spot is white on the skin of his body, does not appear to be deeper than the skin, and its hair is not turned white, then the priest shall isolate the one who has the sore 7 days. This isolation is an example of quarantine. Now, we're living, fortunately, it looks like we haven't had any new cases, at least in America, that have cropped up recently. We're living during a time where we have had a scare with regard to the Ebola virus. And the interesting thing is, and it's peculiar, the politics and what it played in it and those kinds of things, but there are many individuals who are calling for a quarantine of, number one, individuals who are coming from West Africa, and two, even with regard to medical workers who have been working there, and as they came back, and they were asking for a 21-day or more quarantine of these individuals. And basically, the purpose of the quarantine is just as indicated in verse 4 of the text. So we don't think you've got it, but we recognize that if you do have it, then you might spread it, and so we're going to make sure that you're isolated and you're by yourself for a period of time until such time as it can be determined for sure whether or not you have it. That's quarantine. And it's referred to as being isolated here in this particular text. The term quarantine is something that was not used back in the time of the Israelites under the Old Covenant. But the concept is there in this particular passage. Now, if you go down in chapter 13, there's a lot of instructions that are given. But I want to go down to verse 45, because it's interesting, in verse 45 and 46. 45 and 46 of the text. We're told that the leper on whom the sore is, this is that it's a leprous sore. So he is diagnosed with leprosy. What do you do in that case? Well, his clothes shall be torn and his head bare, and he shall cover his mustache and cry, unclean, unclean. He shall be unclean all the days he has the sore, he shall be unclean. He is unclean and he shall dwell alone. His dwelling shall be outside the camp. His dwelling shall be outside the camp. And so this was an isolation. You've heard of leper colonies. They actually have existed until just the recent past, because leprosy was not a disease that had a cure, and because it was something that was could be transmitted to others, it was something that isolation was the way to deal with it. And this was something that was done. Now, the concept of quarantining outside of the Old Testament examples, the next example that you find of quarantining is around the 1300s, which we'll look at. I've got two quotes that I want to make note of. But if you'll note this particular quote here, and I just took this from Wikipedia because I was trying to find how leprosy is transmitted. And the belief is that it is transmitted through basically nasal drops. Sneezing, coughing, you know, that kind of thing. But I think that it's kind of interesting that when a leper came close to an individual, or let's say an individual came close to the leper, what the leper was supposed to do is to say, unclean, unclean. He's covering his mouth and his nose, covering his mustache, is what is stated in the text, and crying out, unclean. And that's the way he was to handle any proximity that he had to any individual. What are we told now? If you're going to sneeze on an airplane, put your nose and your mouth in the crook of your elbow. And I saw a deal on the TV just the other day. They had a simulation of what happens in an airplane if someone sneezes. And it just basically, because of the airflow and everything, everybody gets it. It's not just somebody right beside you. But that's the idea, is to cover your mouth. And as such, you can limit the exposure of other individuals. And I don't know if that in verse 45 is significant, but it is interesting that there is that call to cover basically your nose and mouth and cry unclean, unclean if individuals come around you. So that's an interesting point. Now, the next quote that I have, and I think that that's... No, I've actually got three. three quotes. And let's just read through those, and that would be all the time we'll have. The next quote is from the Encyclopedia of Medical History, and that is that the idea of contagion was foreign to the classic medical tradition and found no place in the voluminous Hippocratic writings. So Hippocrates, of course, the father of medicine, knew nothing of contagion. The Old Testament is a rich source for that contagionous sentiment. In other words, the best way to avoid the spread of this disease is isolation. This was the case with regard to leprosy and also venereal disease. The second quote, this is from the book, A Sketch of Medicine and Pharmacy. This is by S.E. Massengill. It was written in 1943 in the Prevention of Disease. The ancient Hebrews made real progress. The teachings of Moses, as embodied in the priestly code of the Old Testament, contain two clear conceptions of modern sanitation. Now, we make that point. That's the point that we're making here. It's modern sanitation. These, though they have an expression in the Old Testament, they do not have their expression or is regularly recognized by natural knowledge, by what men believe, until much later. But that is the importance of cleanliness or hygiene and the possibility of controlling epidemic disease by isolation and quarantine. And then third, just to give you kind of a quote, you may not can read that well, I'll read it for you, but this is the word quarantine, where it comes from, and when the practice began to be more common, and it was in the 1300s. The word quarantine originates from the Venetian dialect form of the Italian quaranta giorni, meaning 40 days. It's due to the 40-day isolation of ships and people before entering the city of Dubrovnik in Croatia. This was practiced as a measure of disease prevention related to the Black Death. Between 1348 and 1359, the Black Death wiped out an estimated 30% of Europe's population and a significant percentage of Asia's population. The original document from 1377, which is kept in the archives of Dubrovnik, states that before entering the city, newcomers had to spend 30 days, a trentine, in a restricted place, originally some nearby islands that were set aside for that purpose, waiting to see whether the symptoms of Black Death developed. Later, isolation was prolonged to 40 days and was called a quarantine. So that's when the name came about. And although it indicated in that Wikipedia article that there were some examples of quarantine, isolated examples of quarantining a bit before then as well as after, there's very little that is expressed concerning the concept or practice of isolation in order to prevent contagion from the time in which it's expressed with regard to leprosy in the Old Covenant and until the 1300s, when it began to be practiced as a means of dealing with the Black Death, the Black Plague. Now, the next point that I'm going to bring up, and we'll talk about next time, is the touching of the dead bodies. And this one's the other one that I like besides circumcision with regard to dealing with these. We'll talk about that next week, and we'll also get into some of those, the ocean trenches and a few other things to make note of before we get into the discussion of prophecy. So I'll try probably to have enough material next week to deal with that, and then we'll begin with prophecy in 2 weeks. Prophecy is the one, as I indicated earlier, that I think is the most important and the best evidence that we have to establish the inspiration of Scriptures. And we'll talk about that next time. Thank you all for your kind attention as we talk about picky things today.